Remember, this is the Treasury Secretary went over there and just really on more of like a gentleman's agreement said, hey, this is a way that we can work together. It's good for you. It's good for us. Everybody wins scenario. But it wasn't, it's not a treaty. There was no treaty between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Congress did not ratify this agreement. This was an executive branch program that was launched that worked stupendously well. It is probably, I would argue, it is one of the greatest deals in American history.
There are no pacts between lions and men.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Kutzmina. This is Brent Johnson, the man behind the Dollar Milkshake Theory. If you don't know what that is, you're in for a treat, and you can learn more at the top of our at the top of the YouTube channel. There's a playlist that says Start Here that will fill you in on all of that. Those who watch us regularly will note that Brent seems to be on a summer tour. Last week, he recorded from a hotel. He's recording from a fresh one. Brent, where are you this weekend?
This weekend, I'm in Fort Lauderdale. I just did the Real Estate Guys Summit. They have an investor summit where they don't just talk about real estate. They bring in people from different areas to kind of help educate all their members on things other than real estate in which they are already experts. And so they're actually getting ready to go on a week-long cruise. I wasn't able to go on the cruise, but I was able to come up for the last day and a half and spend some time with them. And it was fun.
Excellent. Well, speaking of real estate, you know, we've kind of plugged the last couple episodes, at least last week, the release or the upcoming release of the project that we're doing called Macro Alchemist, inaugural or flagship research project that we're going to release is focused on real estate. Do you want to give a little teaser on that? Because I think at the start of the week, we're going to share that with everybody.
Sure. Well, so, you know, again, for those who haven't heard before, this is kind of a project that a friend of mine who for now is remaining nameless and kind of incognito have been talking about launching for a while. He's been a long time, you know, investor and market participant working for very large institutions around the world. And, you know, this was kind of his brainchild, but it really dovetailed nicely into what we talk about a lot. And that is that despite the problems in the U.S., there's even bigger problems elsewhere. And so we're starting off with somewhat of a take on global real estate focused on China, but then also how that impacts, other markets, specifically other real estate markets around the world. And I'll just leave it at that for now, but hopefully people will check it out and read it and gain some insights in how these markets are different, but how they're also very interconnected.
Yeah, so stay tuned for when we give the nod where everybody can go and dive into that and read that. It'll be at macroalchemist.com, hopefully at the start of the week. So please stay tuned and feel free to check in at that.com at your convenience as the week unfolds. You know, speaking of real estate, one of the things that's very critical and one of the things that real estate is very sensitive to are interest rates. Now, this week, we had inflation data come in within or very, very close to estimates, slightly underestimated numbers, and the market did like that. Do you want to talk about the CPI data and where you think the Fed is going to springboard off of that as far as their policies?
Yeah, so I think, we had more data came out this week and, you know, it came in at expectations or lower than expectations. So, you know, but not dramatically lower, but not hot, not hawkish. And so when the CPI came out on Wednesday morning, which was before the Fed, market jumped quite a bit. But then Powell came out and, you know, it's funny because I think the last couple press conferences have not been Powell's best. And I feel like he's been a little bit more wishy-washy, maybe because they're in this wishy-washy stage. But what was interesting to me was that they indicated that they do think the markets or the monetary policy is too restrictive, which I don't necessarily agree with, but that's what they stated. And here's the interesting thing is their projections for the economy for the rest of the year didn't show any change, but yet they were still predicting up to 2 rate cuts. And so I thought one of the best questions in the press conference at the CPI was when, you know, one of the journalists asked, well, if you don't see the economy weakening at all, and in fact staying strong, then why on earth are you pricing in or why are you expecting 2 cuts? And, you know, Powell's response was that basically saying, we don't want to stay too restrictive to too long and then have to try to save things. We would rather kind of ease into it. So he's basically saying, we're trying to engineer a soft landing. And so I think what's probably going to happen is I think over the next 2 months, we're going to have these very similar to what we've had in the last couple of months, where we have very neutral data and there's something in it for everybody. Some things are going to be a little bit hot. Some things are going to be a little bit weak. But I do think, I don't think they're going to cut again in July. There's another meeting at the end of July. And then 6 weeks later, there's another meeting in the middle of September. I don't think they'll cut in July, but I do think that they will cut in September. And I think they will cut, even though it's just ahead of the election, I think they'll do it just to say they did it and just to say that, you know, because, you know, remember, they got it so wrong a couple of years ago that, and they don't want to lose more credibility. And so I think they don't want to not cut now because they've said and indicated so strongly that they're going to. But it's very possible that they just do one and be done, or it's possible that they end up having to cut aggressively into weakness because the economy's coming down. But either way, I do think the Fed wants to cut. They're pretty clear that they want to cut. This is despite the fact that numbers are pretty good. The economy is in good shape. And I know that there's people who are going to hear me say the economy is in good shape. Say, well, you don't, you know, the fundamentals underneath the waves, you know, underneath the horizon, it's not quite as simple. Listen, I totally agree with you. I'm saying as of right now, things are fine. But based on things under the surface, it could become not fine very quick. And that's kind of what Powell, I think, was saying is everything's fine now, but we don't want to wait for these, you know, waves to start crashing before we start acting. So I think there was a little bit of wishy-washiness in it. But, you know, the market was higher. Bonds rallied like crazy because when interest rates go down, bond prices go high. So that was pretty interesting. And, you know, I think at the end of the week, markets finished kind of at their all-time highs. And the bond prices were, you know, rallied dramatically into the week as well.
One of the areas where there's a big emphasis on a problem in the underlying economy, like you're pointing out, you know, we're looking at data sets and reports that a lot of people would argue aren't very accurate, or at least not very honest. So when you're looking at the real economy, one area that gets a lot of attention is the commercial real estate. And certainly this goes in line with the Macro Alchemist report, but with commercial real estate primarily being a regional or small local bank situation, and you look at these small banks in terms of their balance sheet, you know, they get to mark certain assets, specifically government bonds, not mark to market, but hold to maturity. So underneath, you can see that their balance sheets are a big issue because the bonds they bought in 2020 are now undervalued. And so if there is some sort of concern, a lot of emphasis is on the commercial real estate market. Now, we could also say that this isn't any kind of black swan because we know it exists. But do you think, given some of the other factors, certainly the euphoria in the market, as I mentioned, maybe it's because participants have been front riding the booms and the busts and are expecting the Fed to come in. But do you think the Fed, even out of credibility, would even dancing around the idea of a rate cut if these small regional bank balance sheets weren't under so much pressure because of the bonds that they hold?
Well, I think that I think what you're touching on here is probably the reason that Powell is saying we think that monetary policy is too restrictive and that we do want to start kind of slowing the ship before we come in for the landing, right? But to your I agree. If this issue did not exist with the treasuries being underwater and with the fact that commercial real estate is underwater, I don't even think that they would be talking about it right now. I think, if anything, they would be raising rates in order to slow the economy more. But the thing is this is the problem with debt. And I think a lot of people know this, but that it's worth repeating that the bigger debt gets, and as they grow larger and larger and larger, we've talked about this before where there's this exponential system. The system has to grow. But the more it grows, the more brittle it becomes. And the longer this goes on, it's like a Jenga tower. It's higher, it's higher, it's higher, it's higher. You know eventually it's going to come down, but it's just a matter of when. And, you know, we've got the situation where the tower is rising. The tower looks nice, but you just know from experience it can't go on forever. And I think that is why, despite all the numbers being pretty good, the economic indicators being fine, nothing really of peril out there, they know that it could turn perilous fairly quickly. And I think that's why they're trying to engineer this soft landing. Now, I'll say their history of engineering soft landings is next to zero. I think in 95, they did it fairly well. But other than that, I can't, in 1995, I mean, other than that, I can't remember a time where they've been able to do that. And in fact, it's interesting to hear them being kind of proactive. We know we're trying to get ahead of this so we don't have to react to it. I kind of find that funny because for the most part, central banks are reactive agencies. Their job is to step in when needed, and they're not supposed to be necessarily proactively, you know, trying to make things happen. But I do feel like they are trying to make something happen here, and they're trying to engineer the soft landing. You know, we'll see what happens.
So 95, you started in this business in 98. Is that correct?
I started in 99. Yeah. So I was, you know, 95 is about the time I started watching markets and just kind of reading about them. And I was, you know, I was in college at the time and studying them. So it's more in hindsight. I didn't see it in real time, but I just, you know, looking back through history, that's a time where they cut pretty aggressively. And they were, for the most part, able to engineer a soft landing.
So looking back at that time frame and addressing the idea that the central bank is generally a reactionary mechanism, which over the last two decades, at least, evidence would support that. But makes me think back in that time frame of the 90s, the central bank chairman at the time was Greenspan, and he earned the nickname the Maestro. That's correct, yes?
Yeah,
so, that's correct. So he was more of this, at least perceived at the time, as somebody who was playing this Goldilocks role. Do you believe that, looking back in hindsight and history, or do you think it was just sheer luck, and you think Powell has the potential to move the knobs to his favor?
Well, you know, Greenspan had the reputation of the Maestro. That was kind of his nickname because he was kind of the man behind the curtain pulling all the levers. And really, I think... I give him a little bit of credit because he was there for a very long time and, you know, presided over, you know, great economic growth. But a lot of it just had to do with lower rates, right? I mean, he, Volcker is the guy that, you know, is kind of legendary as far as raising rates and like slowing an economy that was out of control and from an inflation perspective. Greenspan really just facilitated, really by lower rates, the growth that was kind of pent up and ready to go. You know, it's funny, at the time when I first kind of started, I probably drank the Kool-Aid that, you know, he was this great monetary guy. But as I look back, you know, I think all these central bankers are basically the same. They do all the same things. They have the same moves. They all do this. The same trick is to basically provide liquidity when it's needed. Now, they maybe do it in a little bit different fashion. They may speak about it differently, but they're all essentially performing the same magic trick. And so my view of Greenspan has probably dimmed a little bit as I've gotten older and become more accustomed to what they do. You know, I have to tell this story really quick. What made Greenspan kind of amazing was that when he was younger, he was an acolyte of Ayn Rand. And he was very much libertarian, very much free money, very much not into government influence in markets. And then he becomes the head of the Federal Reserve. And all of a sudden, he is the guy pulling all the levers. And a friend of mine, she's one of the smartest people I know, she has said for years that she believes that Greenspan aggressively cut rates and provided easy money policies in order to make the debts grow exponentially on purpose in order to crash the system. So in other words, she thinks he did it on purpose in order to bring the whole system down. In other words, bring the system down from within rather than trying to be like Ron Paul from outside and railing against it. And part of the basis is the fact that he was an Ayn Rand acolyte. He wrote a very famous paper called Gold and Economic Freedom, where he kind of argued for the benefits of free competition and free money, or not free money, but market-based money. And so for him to do such a dramatic pivot, you know, again, her belief is that it was all a ruse, and that he's even surprised that it's still going on. That the 2001 should have, or the dot-com boom should have brought it all down for good. But yet here we are 20 years later, and it's bigger than ever.
Greenspan the mole. That's a new one. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah.
Is there anything interesting? You know, you've now been in the room with a lot of people the last two weekends and conferences. So fresh conversations and ideas come up. The same time, whether you're talking to, you know, frequent friends and contacts, whether it's someone like Cuppy or Todd or Mike Green, is there any thing that is worth sharing? Is there a fresh idea? Is there something that someone is looking at that you thought was intriguing and worth sharing that, you know, hasn't really been talked about a lot yet?
Well, here was the interesting thing, and Todd and I were talking yesterday, and we both said, equities are at a level that you have to be concerned. It doesn't mean you have to sell them all. It doesn't mean you have to predict a crash. But it's just, you know, we've come a long way. So yesterday, there's a number of, one of these signals that a number of people watch is called DMARC. There was a number of DMARC 13 counts on several indices and stocks yesterday. The relative strength, again, was through the roof. You know, sentiment is as high as it's ever been in the last 5 years. So there's a number of signals that are saying, you know, you got to at least be careful on equities here. And the fact, you know, we were talking about how you can, for 1 year, you can buy, if your portfolio is 100% stocks, for 3%, in other words, you can buy a put for 3% that protects your portfolio for an entire year. So the worst case scenario over the next 12 months is you would be down 3%. But then you would have all the upside of the S&P 500 over that time period. That's pretty cheap. To be able to 100% protect your portfolio for 3%. So we kind of talked about that. So for all those reasons, you know, we're at a level in equities where you have to be concerned. That being said, it's hard to find somewhere else to go that looks attractive or that looks more attractive. Again, I know there's people out there saying, no, you got to buy Bitcoin, you got to buy gold. Yeah. Yes, as far as a diversified portfolio, you have to. But again, there's no one other thing out there that's really like lighting up, wow, we should go buy copper. Wow, we should go buy, you know, real estate. Wow, we should go do this, because this, everything is kind of at its highs. Everything has kind of reasons that you would not buy it. And so what Todd and I were talking about is, with a lot of people that we talk up to, they feel the same way, right? And so when everybody feels the same way, then it's probably wrong, right? But the funny thing is, it's kind of like the snake eating itself. Because even though we agree that everybody's looking at it the same way and that can't be right, you can't find any place else to really go to that's really exciting. And so, you know, it's almost like we're in neutral. And, you know, I've said this before. I've been doing this for 25 years now. This is the hardest time to manage money I can remember. Because there's so many different factors at play and there's so many different ways that this can go. And so I'm doing my best to be prepared for everything rather than just trying to figure out one thing that's right. I'm trying to be prepared for all scenarios. But the point I would make to your question is, I've talked to so many people who are kind of in the same boat and they kind of feel the same thing. You know, energy traders haven't had a great year. Precious metals investors didn't have a good first couple months. Then they had a great 6 weeks. And now for the last 4 weeks, hasn't been so great. Real estate guys are just kind of holding on for dear life, right? With the commercial real estate. You know, copper made a huge run and then had a huge pullback. The grains had a big run and now they've pulled back. And so there's no one area that's just like really booming right now, other than AI and equities. But those are the level that makes it unattractive to enter. So it's really a weird time.
Well, at least with all of those things you just shared, at least the insurance is cheap. I mean, there's some comfort in that.
That's right. And the fact, and that we talked about that too, the fact that you can just sit in T-bills with a portion of your portfolio and get 4 or 5%. I mean, that's a great optionality to have.
Awesome. Well, let's get into the biggest topic of the week, or at least at the end of the week, the petrodollar, the end of the petrodollar, the end of the so-called 50-year agreement, 80-year agreement. You know it has to be true when articles can't even get the histrionic number of years that it existed correct. So let's just jump right into it. Brent, give us, you know, your take not only on the petrodollar overall, but, you know, shine some truth or some light on what this whole thing was about.
Okay, so this is a very huge topic, and I'm going to do my best to kind of summarize it as best I can. But this was one of the more maddening weeks. You know, again, when we started this channel, it was going to be, you know, not just about markets, but also madness, and we were going to point out the things that were just people were losing their minds over. Well, you know, this fits well into that category. And I don't know why it still surprises me, but it still surprises me when people are so willing to believe something just because they want it to be true.
Right.
And So as we go back to this, let's talk about what they're talking about to begin with. So in the early 70s, the U.S. cut its link from gold on the dollar. And so from like 71 to 73, we really had just free floating currencies that were not backed by anything. And it kind of had somewhat of a mini currency crisis. At the same time, OPEC countries in the Middle East started boycotting certain countries who they felt were unfairly helping Israel against Arab countries in a military conflict. And so they started an embargo of oil to Western countries. And as a result, you know, oil prices skyrocketed, oil supplies fell, we had gas lines, and, you know, everybody's economy runs on energy. You have to have energy to run an economy. So this was causing problems not just in the U.S. and not just for Richard Nixon, but all over the world. It was causing problems in Japan. It was causing problems in Europe. And so in 73, the head of the – Nixon sent the head of the U.S. Treasury. His name was Simon. I don't remember his first name. Anyway, doesn't matter. The head of the Treasury went – to the Middle East, and he met with a number of different countries, but he specifically went to Saudi Arabia, and he met with the head, the family, the Saud family, and they convinced, and here's where many people get this wrong. They think that the whole agreement was just about pricing oil in dollars. That's not exactly correct, because oil was already priced in dollars. What they convinced them to do was to stop the embargo and start sending more oil to the U.S. So what really happened was that the U.S. secured oil supply for the future, because they didn't want the U.S. economy to be subject to the whims of a country in the Middle East. But as a result of selling all that oil to the United States, now Saudi Arabia was going to receive tons, billions and billions of dollars of revenue. What were they going to do with that revenue? At the time, their economy was extremely small. There is no, if they would have put all of that money directly into the Saudi Arabian economy, the prices would have exploded. It would have been, they couldn't have done it. It would be like trying to put a swimming pool full of water into a pitcher. It wouldn't fit. Saudi Arabia was trying to figure out what if we go back to selling all this oil and we get all these dollars, what are we going to do with it? So part of this meeting was not just securing a supply of oil. It was how could the U.S. help Saudi Arabia use this new revenue most efficiently? And so the Treasury Secretary convinced them to put that money into Treasury bonds. And as a result, they promised them they're not going to get confiscated. You know, we're not going to delink you. In fact, what we will do is we will help maintain your position of power in Saudi Arabia. We will provide you military assistance. So if you're a king of a Middle Eastern kingdom, your number one concern is you want to remain the king of that Middle Eastern kingdom. That is your number one goal. So having the world's superpower at the time on your side, keeping you in power and protecting you, it's not a horrible deal, right? And in exchange, in addition, the U.S. agreed that we are going to help transform your economy from a desert kingdom into a modern, highly sophisticated, technologically advanced country. And that is exactly what has happened. And so as a result, and because that was kind of the arrangement for Saudi Arabia to buy treasury bonds, they had to receive dollars to do it. And so this was a huge win. But the other thing is, remember, this is the Treasury Secretary went over there and just really on more of like a gentleman's agreement said, hey, this is a way that we can work together. It's good for you. It's good for us. Everybody wins scenario. But it wasn't, it's not a treaty. There was no treaty between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Congress did not ratify this agreement. This was an executive branch program that was launched that worked stupendously well. It is probably, I would argue, it is one of the greatest deals in American history. And not only did it help Saudi Arabia, and by the way, over the last 50 years, Saudi Arabia, the standard of living is amongst the highest in the world. They have some of the most technologically advanced society in the world. They have huge, beautiful highways, high-rise buildings, the amazing tourism. So they have gone, from this desert kingdom to a world player. So from their perspective, it worked out. Not only that, the House of Saud is still in power. It worked out great. And it worked out fantastic for the U.S. because after the U.S. delinked from gold, there was some concern about the dollar's continued role as the global reserve currency. But now the fact that the Saudi Arabia was only going to sell their oil in dollars meant that everybody needed dollars because everybody needs energy. And so it went from there was somewhat waning demand for the dollar to now more demand than there had ever been. And then because everybody needed energy and everybody needed dollars to do it, it really solidified the dollar as the global reserve currency. And then that led to the exponential growth of the euro dollar market that we have talked about on several occasions. Now, the other thing that I didn't really say here is that people often think that this was a great deal for the U.S. and not a great deal for Saudi Arabia. Now, I already explained why it was a fantastic deal for Saudi Arabia. But the additional thing that I didn't talk about is the U.S. didn't go there on hand and knee begging for this deal. In fact, the U.S., again, at the time, was the strongest country in the world. And while Saudi Arabia had a lot of oil, they didn't have a huge military. They weren't a huge global presence. If they had said no to the U.S., the U.S. would have probably gone to one of these other families and said, hey, do you want to be king? Right? And what are they going to say? No, I don't want to be king. Of course they want to be king, right? So then all of a sudden, the House of Saud has the U.S. as an enemy rather than a partner. So, you know, it's kind of even if you don't love the other guy or the other woman or the other team, it's kind of the devil you know, right? And so we chose the devil we know, and they chose the devil they knew. And it worked out for everybody. And so the idea now that 50 years later, this agreement, which there was never, again, there's never a legal document that said this is going to expire in 50 years. Now, people will say, but I saw this piece of paper or I saw this communique. Okay, if I went to a meeting, a business meeting, or you know, one of these conference presentations I'm at, and I took notes and I sent them back to my home and filed them away, and then 40 years from now, somebody pulls out my notes and reads about it, that doesn't mean that I was part of an official deal. It just means I was there and watched this presentation, saw how it went down, and I documented it. So yeah, there are memos out there that explain what happened and explain kind of how it goes, but these are not official treaties that have been ratified by two different governments. It's just kind of how they decided to work together. Okay, so let's bring that back to today. Because people want to believe that the US dollar is on death's door, someone somewhere on some podcast or some, TikTok video or some, Twitter post says, holy cow, 50 years later, this is over, hasn't been renewed. And so, they're ditching the dollar. Well, they're not ditching the dollar. First of all, they were selling dollars before the agreement. They continued to sell dollars during the agreement, and they're continuing to sell in dollars now. So this idea that all of a sudden Saudi Arabia is no longer going to use dollars, it's silly. And people, took this TikTok meme or what, I don't even know how it started, but however it started, and then it started going around, and other people started talking about it. And then journalists who didn't do their research, said, well, I can't miss out on this. This is such a great headline. They started writing about it. It just kind of created a life of its own. But there's no evidence. There's nothing that says this actually ended. The other thing is that the dollar went higher this week, not lower. And by the way, I don't know if people know this or not, but Saudi Arabia's currency, it's pegged. You know what it's pegged to? It's not pegged to gold. It's not pegged to rubles. It's not pegged to yuan. It's pegged to the U.S. dollar. So if they're going to stop selling in U.S. dollars, then they must not believe very much in their currency, right? If they're getting out of the dollar because it's a shitty currency, then what does that say about their currency that it has to be pegged to the dollar to give it some stability? On the one hand, it's amusing. On the other hand, it's maddening. But on the other hand, it's just very frustrating just to when you see these things and people like perpetuate it, even though there's literally no truth to it. But then let's pretend for a second that it is true. Let's pretend that there was a document. Let's pretend that there was a treaty. Let's pretend that Saudi Arabia literally said, we're not renewing it because we no longer like the dollar. What would that mean for markets? Well, a lot of the people that have been reposting this is saying it means it's horrible for the U.S. The dollar is going to lose global reserve status. It's going to fall. It's going to go away. It's not going to be worth anything. You're going to lose all your money and you got to get into gold or you got to get into Bitcoin or whatever it is. Well, let's think through what would actually happen if this was the case. We've documented many times on this show, and I've talked about it many times on the presentations, is all the dollar debt in the world, not just from the U.S. issuers, but from people and entities outside the U.S. And they owe just as much as the U.S. owes in dollars to each other. So if Saudi Arabia stops selling oil in dollars and starts selling it in yuan or gold or rupees or whatever it is, rubles, then that means there's going to be less dollars circulating in the world. And if there's less dollars circulating in the world, that means there's less supply of dollars available. And if there's less supply of dollars available, how are the countries and entities that owe all this U.S. dollar debt going to service and pay off that debt? It'll be harder to get dollars rather than easier to get dollars if it's no longer sold in dollars. And so all of a sudden, those debts that are no longer getting serviced and are no longer getting paid off start to go into default. What does that cause? It causes a further supply crunch where there's even fewer dollars available, but all the debt still exists. And so you get the situation where if this actually happened, the price of the dollar would rise on the global stage versus its peers rather than fall. So then you get into the question, well, if the dollar is rising versus the other currencies, then why on earth would you sell your most prized commodity in a weaker currency than the dollar? Even if these headlines are true, which they're not, but if they were true, it wouldn't have the effect that many of the proponents of this theory are saying it would have. So, I encourage people when they see these headlines, I'm not saying to ignore them. It is news. If somebody says this is happening, it is worth seeing. Well, is it really happening? But, don't just accept the first conclusion that you read. Part of the reason we do this show is we want to try to help educate people of how the system actually works and the way things, kind of go on both behind the scenes and in the real world. And so when you see these headlines, you really have to think a little bit and make sure you understand what the implications are. Because oftentimes when things are getting sent around like this, there's a certain motivation that these people have in order to do this. And you got to think about what their motivations are. And for those people who say that, well, Brent, you have a motivation too. You're trying to push a narrative. Yeah, that is true. But I'm also trying to give you both sides of the story. And I don't really care whether you believe me or not. I'm trying to get you to understand how the system works. And you can ultimately decide for yourself. But what we really want and what we hope people get out of this show is kind of a more balanced take. What's going on? What does it actually mean? And I think this week perfectly was representative of the type of stuff that we try to debunk and try to help people think through.
It's the Italian statement, qui bono,
that's
benefits.
Right. That's right.
And, when something like this comes along, those who benefit from trying to sell you, whether it's a Bitcoin investment strategy or precious metals investment strategy, and all those things are an important part of the portfolio depending on what your investment time horizon is and what your risk profile is. So not to say any of those investments don't have a time and a place, but there are people who are definitely trying to benefit by selling you a narrative instead of really looking underneath the hood and getting the actual details on it. I'll also highlight one of your mic drop moments. You did a debate on Zero Hedge with Jim Rickards, and you had talked, it was a 2-hour long thing, but there really is this 2-minute soundbite that's priceless, because you're talking about the euro dollar market. And for those who are somewhat unfamiliar or need a little bit more detail on that, please, again, we talk about it every time at the start of the podcast. Go to the Start Here playlist. we introduce you to those things in a couple of 50-minute clips, so we won't do it here. But the Eurodollar market is basically these countries in the periphery outside of the main U.S. that have lent to each other dollars. They owe those debts to each other. So if there was ever a mass default, or, you know, as people often push on you, Brent, well, what if everyone just decides they no longer want the dollar? Where they're basically defaulting on each other first. Eventually that will come home to roost, but the mic drop moment you had with Jim was saying, you know, okay, what will happen to the dollar when these debts start to go into default amongst each other before it even reaches the shores of the U.S.?
The Eurodollar market outside the U.S., these entities, they don't have the ability to create dollars out of thin air. So they actually have to go source them somewhere. The only people that can create dollars out of thin air is the U.S. government. And so, you know, if you think about the Cantillon effect, you know, the people closest to the money benefit the most, and the further you are from the money, the less you benefit from it. That's kind of the Eurodollar market. As long as everything is working and, you know, the music is playing and money is circulating, the Eurodollar market works just fine. But the minute the music stops and you start to get this credit contraction, they have nobody that can bail them out, unless the U.S. decides to bail the rest of the world out. And so far, for the most part, the U.S. has decided to do it. But they have not decided to bail the rest of the world out to the detriment of the U.S. And so in that situation, the U.S. will get bailed out first, and then the rest of the world will get bailed out. But the other thing I would say is, a lot of the times when people talk about the impending or the imminent or the eventual death of the dollar, it all has to do with the fact that we have too much debt and there are consequences to have too much debt. What I find hilarious is that then the same people who say the U.S. has too much debt and there are consequences to having U.S. debt will then, as part of their argument for de-dollarization, say the rest of the world is just going to default on their U.S. dollar debt. So they say defaulting on your U.S. dollar debt will work for the rest of the world, but it won't work for the U.S. Now, why will it work for the rest of the world, but it won't work for the U.S.? You got to be kind of consistent in your thinking. And I always kind of get a chuckle out of that one when people say, oh, they'll just stop using it and won't pay them. Well, fine. If that's what if you believe that debt doesn't have any consequences, then what's the problem with the U.S. having all this debt?
Well, look, Brent, we'll leave it there. I don't think this petrodollar thing is over. Hopefully this gave some, you know, insights into what actually is the truth of the story versus the hyperbolic narratives that keep getting tossed around anytime anyone can grab onto a headline that's screaming about the end of the dollar. Look, you can join Brent on Twitter and continue this conversation and share your opinion on it using his handle, SantiagoAUFund. You can find me using the handle, John Kutzmita. You can find this show both on Twitter and on YouTube using the handle, Milkshakes Pod. That'll do it for this weekend. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week. You don't get fooled again. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.